We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
Pardon the interruption, my friends. I don't normally do this, but since it is the season finale, I wanted to cut in the middle of the interview here to reach the folks who do not listen to the beginning of the program as well as the end of the show. I know you're out there. You don't want to hear the Banal Talking Head segments, but since this is the final edition of the program here for Season 5, I want to make a special point of reaching out to all of you and asking for your help in making BOA Audio financially solvent as we close the book on Season 5 and get ready to start putting together Season 6. No matter what you donate, it all helps, folks. It really does, trust me. So please help us out and make a donation. It would be greatly appreciated. And now let's get back to David Icke on the season finale of BOA Audio Season 5.
So, you know, the webpage or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Now, I want to revisit a pivotal moment here in your career as a researcher and in your life, really, and that's the Terry Wogan interview from 1991. Now, what... I guess just sort of take us back to that and what was going through your mind when all that went down, because I saw, you know, segments of it, and you looked almost overwhelmed during the whole thing, like there was just so much going on with you that almost, it felt almost like a setup, if you will, like they were taking advantage of someone who, you know, was going through this very turbulent change. But I'm interested in, you know, your take on it all.
You make some good points, actually, there. Yes, a lot of that was exactly what was happening. But, again, if you look at it from another point of view, it takes on another meaning, but certainly in my life. What happened in the lead-up to that, and it's important to explain the lead-up to it, I went to that psychic I mentioned earlier who told me that I was going to go out on a world stage and reveal great secrets, which at the time, although one level of me thought, yes, this feels right to me, another level of me that's lived in this world, you know, for decades and stuff like that, I was in the 30s at the time, I think, was going, I'm going to do what? You know, what you're talking about. Anyway, after that, I started to go through a series of incredible synchronistic experiences during the year of 1990, after I saw this psychic in March 1990. And and this has gone on to this day, it was like some unseen force has been handing me pieces in a jigsaw puzzle, virtually in the order I need to have them to most easily understand them. And one of the things that I was told through the psychic in that period was, no need for arduous searching. It was all you need is to follow the clues. It was all arranged a long time ago. And that's the experience, I have to say, over these 20 years that I've had. And so during that year, I got more and more kind of a grasp on what was happening to me. And I wrote a book called Truth Vibrations, which I finished by the end of 1990, and it went off to the printers. Now, towards the end of 1990, I then had this constant theme in my life and this urging to go to Peru. And I'd be walking down the street, and I'd see an advert for Peru and all the rest of it. And it was just... and by this time, I was starting to understand, having been at it for a year, that this synchronicity of coincidence was actually what I call the language of life. It's life talking to you in the language of synchronicity and coincidence and symbols, etc. So even though I had very little money at the time because I left the BBC and not earned any money for best part of a year, I jumped on a plane to Peru. But anyway, long story short, loads and loads of amazing things happened to me. And I ended up in a place called Siyustani, not far from, about an hour's drive from a place called Puno in Peru. And I'd stayed at a hotel in Puno, which was called the Siyustani, and had pictures of this place. It's an Inca ruins site. And so I hired this tourist bus with this tourist guide and stuff that was with me, and we went off. And I went there, and it was a very nice place and beautiful. But and I spent about an hour there among the ruins, and it was nice. But when I went back to the bus, I thought, well, what I've just experienced does not match the urging I had to be here. So I was very disappointed. And I got in this bus with windows on the side, a little mini bus, as we call them in Britain. And we go off back to Puno, but about no more than 3 minutes down the road from Seyustani, in this completely uninhabited area, virtually, I looked across to my right and I saw this mound. This is February 1991. And I looked at the mound, and all I could hear in my head when I looked at the mound was, come to me, come to me, come to me. And I thought, crikey, that mound's talking to me. But it wasn't a mound. It was just an indication, this is significant. So I said to the guy, can you stop the bus? I'm going up that mound. I'll only be a minute. Well, I thought I'd be only a minute, but I was over an hour because of what happened. And I walk up this mound, and I didn't see it from the road, but when I got to the top, there was this standing stone circle, which I've actually seen on the internet while I was writing this book, actually. The first time I've seen it since I was there. And I walked into the middle of it, and I'm looking back to Seyustani across the valley and the distant mountains. And then my feet start to burn. Now, I'd had this experience before at the start of my experience in 1990, but that's another story. And anyway, it starts to burn, and it's like magnets. My feet are like being pulled to the ground. And then I felt like a drill going into the top of my head and down through my body into the earth, and another flow of energy coming the other way and out the top. And then this, not voice, but very strong thought form, which didn't come from me, just went through my mind and said, first of all, they'll be talking about this 100 years from now, and I'm thinking, talking about what? And the second line immediately afterwards was, it will be over when you feel the rain. And I'm standing at that time under a cloudless Peruvian sky with a piercing, very, very hot sun, and it was ridiculous that it will be over when you feel the rain. I thought I could be here a month. And anyway, what happened then is my arms went out at 45 degrees without me deciding to do it, and above my head. And this energy then started to get more and more and more powerful, to the point where my body was shaking. And this went on over a period of the best part of an hour, where I kept going in and out of, consciousness, really, in a way. It's the same principle as driving a car and daydreaming and then wondering where the last 2 miles have gone. Your subconscious has been driving the car. I mean, we'd all be dead without the subconscious, of course. Anyway, one of the times when I came back to awareness of the situation I was in, I noticed that over the distant mountain, some way away, there was a light gray mist. And as I watched it, this happened really fast. And over quite a short period, it became a dark gray mist, and it was obvious it was pouring with rain over the distant mountains. And over the next little while, and it was, I was only there about an hour, and it's been going for some time by the time this happened. This rainstorm came out of these distant mountains, and as it got closer, it was just a straight line. It was literally like, I've described it many times, like pulling curtains across the sky. It was a straight line. And eventually the sun was covered up, and in the end, I'm watching a wall of stair rod rain coming towards me in like a straight line. It was just an extraordinary experience. I mean, if you wrote it in a novel, they say, well, that's a bit far-fetched, isn't it? But it happened. Yeah. And eventually, the rain hit me, and at that point, by the time the rain hit me, I mean, my body is just shaking like it's plugged into a nuclear power station. And then when the rain hit me, the energy stopped, and I staggered forward. I could hardly stand because my shoulders that I hadn't felt, my arms had been up at 45 degrees all this time. Yeah. I couldn't feel before, was suddenly agony. Anyway, the reason I tell this story is that whatever happened there was the equivalent of having my consciousness or my mind smacked with like an Exocet missile, and it just broke the eggshell. It broke the bubble that I lived in up to that point, the bubble of perception. And suddenly, over the next few days and then weeks, my mind was just flooded with a tidal wave of information, concepts, perceptions. And it was like pressing too many keys on the computer too quickly. The computer says, can't process this, I'm freezing.
Yeah.
And that's basically what happened to me, Tim. I was processing so much information that basically the computer froze. And that's, at that point, synchronistically, I was invited onto the Terry Wogan Show, which at that time was the biggest, one of the biggest prime time audience shows in Britain. And the night I was on, I think they got 17 million in a country of just over, at that time, 50 million. So that's the ratio you're talking about, because it had been all in the papers, this guy Ike's gone crazy. So when I was talking to him, I was still in that state of bewilderment, what's happening to me? And it was funny because while I was talking to him, it was live, of course, and the audience were laughing and ridiculing me and all the rest of it. And after that interview, of course, I was ridiculed wherever I went, mercilessly, constantly, for at least 2 years. Anyway, as I was talking to him, I was aware of two levels. There was the level of David Icke, who had been a television presenter and respected, you know, person in the public eye in Britain, who was dying a death, you know, oh my God, what have I done? I've destroyed my life. But there was another level of me, which I was so aware of while I was doing the interview, that was saying, it's going to be fine. It's leading somewhere. Don't worry about it. This is leading somewhere. It's going to be fine. And with the passage of what we call time, it has been. But again, about my journey, the things that happened to us, what happened to me as a result of that interview, like I say, is I went through the most amazing levels of ridicule. I mean, there can be few people in this country, possibly anywhere, who've been through such a concentrated, massive, unmerciless period of mass ridicule. I mean, I couldn't walk down the street. Going into a pub or a bar, forget it. There was uproar, you know, and it was just an incredible experience. I would stop at my car at the traffic lights, and the people in the cars around me would be laughing at me. It was just, you just couldn't get away from it. And when you go through that level of ridicule, then one of two things happen. Either you go crazy, or you go away and hide, and it's over. Or you break through something. You break through that fear of what other people think of you, and how other people perceive you. And I wrote a book just after that called "I Am Me, I Am Free," which was basically inspired by the fact that I went through this process of letting the mass ridicule serve me in a way. I didn't realize I was doing it at the time, but with hindsight I can see it, to release me from the prison that most people live in, which is the fear of what other people think. Now, in my journey up to this point, and again, we come back to what we were talking about right at the start with the reptilians, if I had not been through that process of mass ridicule and therefore cleansing this concern with what other people thought of me, there is no way in the world that I would ever go public about shape-shifting reptilians.
Yeah.
The number of people that have said to me, look, mate, I've seen it. I'll tell you what I've seen it, but don't mention my name. I can't take the stick I'll get if people know it's me. If someone's going to put these things out, for goodness sake, mate, if someone's going to talk about the moon not being real and all that stuff, along with reptilians and along with this is an illusory reality, then if you've got any vestiges of worrying about what people think of you and how they might ridicule you, laugh at you, dismiss you, then forget it. You ain't going to go there.
Yeah.
And this is why the personal journey of people doing this and the information that they are uncovering and pursuing and communicating are fundamentally connected, because the person has to work on themselves to get to a point where they can put this information out, because if they don't, then they're not going to put it out, and they're going to say, I'll go here, because people won't laugh at me here up to this point, but I ain't going there. And therefore, all this information, which people need to have access to so they can say, well, what do I think of it, would never get circulating. You know what? When I came across the reptilian stuff, I put reptilian ETs and variations of those words into a search engine, and I got a handful of pages. Put those words in now. Tens and tens and tens of thousands of them. That's because once it gets out and it starts circulating, then it's got a chance of having people look at it and think, well, it may sound crazy, but let's just look at it without preconceived idea. Do you know, this seems to make sense. People, number of people have said to me, it makes sense to me. It shouldn't. I know it shouldn't, but it does when I look at it. But they wouldn't say that unless someone put it out there.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and it must be, you know, gratifying because, what happened in that interview, everyone was kind of laughing at you and everything. And, you know, I saw the 2006 Wogan interview, and it seemed like it was a complete reversal. I mean, it seemed like they were laughing at him almost for being sort of clueless to what's going on.
Yeah, that's an interesting that you should bring that up because when I was asked to go on the Wogan show just a few years ago now, where he was interviewing guests that he'd interviewed in his previous series years ago that I talked about.
Yeah.
I said yes immediately because something told me this is the end of an era. This is tying the ends of that period of your life. And so, because by this time, of course, I'm a very, very different person. I'm a much wiser person. I've had that come to me through sheer experience. I understood so much more. I wasn't in a bewildered state anymore, thinking what's happening to me or what the heck's going on. I mean, I was only weeks. It's only like a few weeks after that experience in Peru that I was sitting in that studio in the first interview. So when I went on, it was a very, very different interview. And I walked out of that studio that day, and I thought, okay, new era starts now. That's the old one. That's the ends tied of the old one. Now we start a new one, and that's pretty much what has happened. So it's funny how life works and how we attract these synchronistic things to us, which we call coincidence, but are not coincidence at all.
Well, while we're talking about sort of like periods of your life, I feel compelled to ask you about this whole turquoise period because I know I've heard a lot about it, and I feel like I haven't really heard anything about it from you in recent years, maybe because people are afraid to embarrass you about it. I don't mean to, put you on the spot or embarrass you about it. I mean, I feel like maybe it's sort of like the whole idea of, like, people's hairstyles in the 80s, you know? Like, what was I thinking back then? Is that what this is all about? Or, you know, what was going on with the whole turquoise period?
It's real simple. It just fits in with what we've been talking about. After I'd had that experience on the mound in Peru, and I came back to Britain, I became extraordinarily attracted to the color turquoise. Simple as that. And it was so fast after the experience in Peru on the mound that clearly the two were massively completely connected. And of course, turquoise is a sacred stone, sacred color to Native Americans and stuff like that. And with the first time I met Credo Mutwa in South Africa, he was decked from his neck to his feet in bright turquoise. So I was very, very attracted to that color for about 3 months, and I used to wear it all the time. And then after the Wogan interview, the first one, and I went through all that massive ridicule, and I'm still thinking, what's happening to me? Suddenly, it was like waking up. It was a period about 3 months from the mound to what I'm about to talk about. I kind of was almost woke up one morning, and everything had morphed into some kind of clarity, and if you like, the computer had unfrozen. And as the computer unfroze, so I ditched the turquoise. I didn't feel that I needed to wear that anymore, and I haven't ever since. But I still think it's a lovely color. I mean, you know, I've got a lot of, I like that color a lot. And,
yeah.
But, you know, it was just that period where I was massively attracted to it. Because, of course, you know, as you well know, Tim, everything's a vibration. The color's a vibration. And colors, like all vibrations, carry certain amounts of information. They affect you emotionally because they affect you vibrationally. This is why when someone puts a certain color on, they'll say, oh, you look so good in that color. It just makes you sort of vibrant.
Yeah.
Then you put another color on, and it just takes all the energy, all the color out of your face. And yet someone else could swap those colors and have the opposite experience to you. So we think with different vibrations, which we call colors and shades of color, in different ways. And at that point, because of something going on in me vibrationally, because of that mound, I became very attracted, i.e. vibrationally connected, attracted to the color turquoise. And then when the computer unfroze, if you like, bang, the turquoise I was not attracted to it anymore in the same way.
Okay, interesting. Now I'm going to sort of hit some just general sort of questions. Now, in your work, you pretty much say the reptilians are a race of, for lack of a better term, ancient aliens, let's say. With that in mind, what do you make of contemporary UFOs and what's going on here with the UFO phenomenon of the last 60 years or so?
Well, because there are so many levels to this, and there are so many aspects to this tapestry of knowledge, and this tapestry that is the world that we live in, and there's so many levels to it, so many vibrational levels to it, and what have you. It's difficult because you talk on one level, okay, about the five sense level, and you'll use certain words, and then you'll talk about another level, the interdimensional level, and you might use other words. So I don't talk about them as extraterrestrial, though they're obviously, if they're not of the Earth, they're extraterrestrial. Everything is.
Yeah.
I call them interdimensionals because I think they move in and out of this reality. But of course, what we're dealing with is all possibility. You know, when I perceive infinite reality, I perceive its core as all possibility, infinite potential, unmanifest potential, and that manifests itself as stillness and silence. Because we think that silence, you say to people, what can you hear? And they go, nothing. But actually, they can hear everything, because within the silence is all possibility, unmanifest. When I start talking, I am pulling one possibility out of all possibility, and when I stop talking, it's gone back into all possibility again. And so the core of infinite reality is actually stillness and silence. It's unmanifest potential. And this is why when I was the only time I've taken a psychoactive drug called ayahuasca in Brazilian rainforest in 2003, this voice, take a female form, talked to me for 5 hours in great detail about the illusory nature of reality. And one of the things it said to me was, if it vibrates, it's illusion. Because the base state of everything is stillness and silence. If it vibrates, it's illusion. It's creation out of all possibility. And so we have these worlds that we call realities, like this frequency range and another dimensional frequency range and all the rest of it, which are actually vibrating to a certain speed. That creates the reality and the frequency range within which a certain experience reality exists. And, of course, like I say, they interpenetrate each other like radio stations. So what we're dealing with when we talk about extraterrestrials and other forms of life not of this world, we're actually dealing with all possibility. Therefore, anything is possible. So, you know, when you look at the different forms there are in this world, different human forms from the Chinese to the black South Africans, etc., and all the amazingly different forms in the animal kingdom, the animal realm, that's just a tiny, 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 tiny fraction of all possibility that we're looking at. And look at the diversity. It's unbelievable. So then you take it on to the next stage, Tim, when you go beyond this planet or even beyond this reality, and then just multiply the potential of possibilities and manifestations of possibility, and but, well, crikey, you're into infinity already.
Yeah.
So when I talk about the reptilians, I'm just talking about one aspect, one expression of a form, a species, if you like, but there are infinite other forms out there that are in different states of awareness. Some of them are very intellectually dominated and they're therefore very technologically advanced, but very spiritually dead, and they can be very dangerous and destructive because they're very clever, but they're not wise, and cleverness without wisdom is the most destructive force you could come across, because, you know, you can be clever enough to make an atomic bomb, but if you're wise, then you don't, and you're certainly wise if you don't drop it.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with these reptilians that appear to be very intellectually advanced, therefore technologically advanced and aware of how you can manipulate energy and situations and mind control and all the rest of it, but they do not, they're not expansive enough in their consciousness to use that knowledge wisely. So they use it for control and manipulation and imposition. But there are other non-human species out there in their different forms, both within this reality and in other realities that intersperse with this one or interact with it, that do have an awakened consciousness and do have a benevolent agenda, if you like, or view of the Earth and humans and what we're going through. So there are many, many different forms out there, and it's not just about, you know, if you like, controlling extraterrestrial or interdimensionals, and that's it. There are many, many different aspects of this. And so, you know, people can have experiences of non-human entities, and some of them can be of the manipulating type, but some of them can be the benevolent type. It's just, there are so many different, see, this is the funny thing. People say, is there life out there? Do you think extraterrestrials are visiting the Earth? I mean, if we only realized it, I mean, there's enormous numbers of different species that are interacting with this planet.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, just we found one. There's loads of them. But most of them operate outside of our immediate frequency range of what we call visible light and electromagnetic spectrum that we can decode. And therefore, we don't see them. And I think that maybe a major part of this epoch change as we expand our consciousness is that we are going to start to encompass and interact as a matter of course eventually with these other extraterrestrial non-human species groups, because there's so many out there.
Okay. Here's sort of a question that just came to me throughout the course of this conversation here now. It's sort of a really big picture question, but it's one that I'm really intrigued to ask you, and that's, you know, in light of all this stuff, okay, you know, the illusory nature of reality and the multiple dimensions and the reptilians and everything else, I guess, have you ever pondered the nature of a God entity? You know, what's your take on, you know, the ultimate creator? I mean, do you think that it's some sort of intelligence, or is it some sort of like mathematical equation or a wave, if you will, you know, something that's a force of nature more so than, you know, an intelligent designer, if you will? Like, what do you think of all that?
Well, you know, we go back to what I was talking about a few minutes ago. For me, what people call God, what I call the infinite, is that silent, still, all possibility. And from that becomes manifest worlds.
Okay.
And in because we're all, in the end, the same consciousness, we are all that infinite possibility made manifest. In the end, we're all the infinite. We're all expressions of it. And in so many ways, it seems to me that what we're experiencing is the infinite experiencing itself. In other words, as we experience ourselves, we are the infinite experiencing itself. And I look upon this reality. And of course, you know, if you're going to experience yourself, it's not always, you know, imagine if you went through life, and I mean, I can talk from my own experience big time about this, I already have. If I went through my life and from the time I was born to now, I'd had it easy and everything had been fine and rosy and I hadn't had any challenges and I hadn't had all these things that have happened to me, would I be doing what I'm doing now, saying what I'm saying now? No way would I be doing what I'm doing now. So, you know, experience is experience, and sometimes it's experience we don't like and sometimes it's experience we do like, but it's just an experience. And if we can pull back from I am David Icke, I am my experience, to I am infinite consciousness having an experience as David Icke, having these experiences, then you kind of one step back from getting pulled completely into the experience and becoming engulfed by it. And the way I see, this is the thing, Tim, you know, it's difficult sometimes because you get asked questions, and understandably, in different situations over the time, about this, that, and the other, and you answer them from the point of view that the question's being given.
Yeah.
But what actually I'm doing is I'm seeing all these different things at different levels, but realizing that they're just points of observation. So from the point of observation of humans in a physical body having an experience now, the world is being taken over by crazies and being taken over by deeply flawed people who are using computer program type people in uniforms and dark suits to take the world over for them. At that point, you know, you can observe it from that point. From another point, you can observe it and say, actually, it's a group of extraterrestrials that are taking over this planet, or interdimensionals who are taking over this planet, and they're using these people in dark suits and uniforms to do it. And then you can go wider and wider to the point where you say, it's all a game. It's all a cosmic game. That's all it is. It's just an experience. And we're experiencing a very challenging part of this yuga cycle, this vibrational cycle that manifests itself as apparently the cycular nature of what we call time. But time and space are just what we decode from the information construct into the appearance of time and space in the holographic world. When I look at it from the big picture, it's an experience, and there was no one on another level pointing an AK-47 at our consciousness and saying, "Get in that body or I shoot." So what we need to ask the question is, why did we choose to be here at this time having this experience? It's like the Oracle said to Neo in The Matrix, you're not here to make a choice. You've already made the choice. That is being here. What you need to understand is why you made the choice. And what happens is when consciousness is experiencing through the lens of the physical body, the body computer, it has its perception range limited and suppressed because it is experiencing this reality through a vehicle. And it's like when a spaceman goes out in space, he's limited by the vehicle that he wouldn't be if he wasn't in the spacesuit. Yeah. I mentioned this in the book. I had an experience maybe a couple of years back now, where I'm sitting in the bath and suddenly this series of pictures appeared to me. And the first one was billowing energy. It was a yellow billowing energy, which I took for some reason immediately to be consciousness. And then an eye appeared in the energy, and then in front of the eye appeared a telescope. And on the end of the telescope was the Earth and this solar system, this universe. And then the last movement was that the telescope morphed into a human body. So the eye, consciousness, is looking through the body into this reality. And so what happens is that we experience our lives here from the limited perception of the lens, the body computer, but that level of us that made the decision to be here and to experience this actually is not subject to that limitation. So therefore we go through our lives and we're saying, I'd never have agreed to this, I'd never have done it, stupid, never would I have agreed to this. But then again, you it's like, you're not here to make the choice.
Yeah.
You're here to understand why you made the choice. And the more that people expand their consciousness, the more they break out of the imprisonment of preconceived idea and preconceived rigid belief, the more they vibrationally get closer to that level of self, which is outside of the body computer. And when you do that, I know from my own experience, the more you start to then understand, ah, I understand why I am here doing this and why all these things have happened to me, because it was to get me to this point in terms of my understanding so I could do what's coming next. And it's a completely different way of looking at the world and looking at our own lives. I wouldn't change. Well, maybe it's a couple of things I would change, but there were people that came into my life and caused mayhem. But apart from that, and again, they provided experiences. Same thing, really. It's just that I would rather not had them. But when I look at my life and my experience now, I don't see it the way I did before. I started to look at life differently, and life is easier when you do that, because you don't get pulled into this, why me? Why am I so unlucky? You know, how could this happen to me? I'm just a good guy trying to do good things. Why is this happening to me? Because you start to realize that you know, the experiences you have that often you don't like are the ones that give you the greatest gifts. I've said many times in my books over the years, life it has this brilliant ability to give you your greatest gifts, brilliantly disguised as your worst nightmare. I mean, we've all experienced that. I'm sure I have.
Absolutely.
And you look back and you think, I wouldn't want to experience it again, but I'm glad that I did, because it led here. And there's so much going on in our lives, and there's so much going on around us. There's so much going on in our awareness. And if you start to read the language of life, which is how the holographic world talks to us, because the holographic world is a manifestation of the energy, the information construct, by reading the signs in the holographic world, you're actually, with your conscious mind, reading the information construct, and therefore you can see things. It's like if you decide, preconceived idea, this is what I want to do with my life, and this is, I'm not taking anything else. Well, that's fair enough. That's a choice. But what if the door to what you want to do just won't open? What do? You bang it a bit more? What do? Kick it now? It's still not opening. And yet over there is a door swinging open, saying, over here, this is for you. But no, I want to do this. And so being fluid and not rigid, because when we have any form of preconceived rigid belief, then we're already limiting all possibility.
Yeah.
To access all possibility, we need to be on that airbed, not standing there in the river saying I ain't moving, because what that's saying is I have now limited my possibility to I ain't moving. That's it. There is no other possibility.
Yeah.
But you get on the airbed and you flow with it and you say, look, I'll go where life takes me and I'll go where my intuition feels to go. Life starts to be an adventure, and that's open to everybody. Everybody. All we need to do is to remove the cause of the problem, and that's preconceived idea, preconceived belief, and the perception of self that we are David Icke, Ethel Jones, or Charlie Smith. We ain't. That's our experience. When we realize that we are infinite consciousness, infinite potential, having that experience, then our sense of limitation starts to dissolve.
Interesting. Okay. Now, taking things down to a purely human level here, and as someone who, you know, is obviously an icon of the conspiracy research genre, what do you make of what seems to be sort of a stagnation of the whole 9/11 truth movement? I mean, it seemed like it had a lot of momentum going for it up until about the 5th anniversary, and it's sort of been sort of winding down since then. It's really not the hot button topic it used to be.
No, well, there's a few reasons for that, I think, and one of the main ones is the passage of what we call time. It's like Bill Hicks, the great American comedian. He, as part of his act, he used to say that people used to say to him, "What do you keep going on about the Kennedy assassination, man? It's long ago. Forget about it." You know, and he says, "Well, don't keep talking about Jesus to me then, you know." But the point I'm making is that it's like, oh, that's the Kennedy assassination. The fact that the Kennedy assassination was an incredibly potent example of the way the control system works and how it manipulates and covers up, people forget because it was back then. And with every year that passes, of course, in the public mind, 9/11 becomes less and less important. I mean, even the manipulators are hardly talking about it now. So that, of course, is a real basic reason why it's lost its momentum. And also, ironically, my feeling is that it's actually a fundamentally important area of research, because if you can show that 9/11, as it can be, but if you can get it in the public arena that in a massive way, that 9/11 was a scam, then everything that's followed since it is part of that scam. I mean, Afghanistan, Iraq, I mean, they kind of directly connected to 9/11, but they bloody tried, and the whole atmosphere of going in there came from 9/11. The war on terror, the police state, the Orwellian state, all comes back to 9/11. So it is a fundamentally important subject, and I'm very sad that it has lost momentum, because it needs to go on being uncovered and go on being exposed, because in so many ways it's the thing that on everything else rests upon that's come since it happened. And another area that I would suggest that is related to this, Tim, is that, you know, there comes a point where you keep saying the same thing, and it might be true, but you're going round in circles. What is there left but to say the same thing again?
Yeah.
And this is what happens if you operate, as we were talking about earlier, in this "I'm going here but no further" realm. I'm going here but no further. Once you say that, then all you can do in the end is just repeat yourself, because the area you're working in eventually gets worked out in terms of anything new.
Yeah.
But if you say, look, let's just look at this dispassionately, okay? Let's just take a deep breath and just sit back and look at this. Look at how the control system is coming in a multi-leveled, synchronistically connected way, where you've got everything from food additives to banking scams to oil disasters to wars to the medical scam to the transnational corporation pharmaceutical scam, and then you've got the manipulation of the military, you've got the manipulation of governments, you've got the World Health Organization manipulating this vaccine. Look at it. Look at it, how it's all coming in across the world together. And then tell me that it's being orchestrated by a group of men, mostly men, in dark suits, sitting around a table saying, okay, what's our next move? It ain't. It's bigger than that. It's much bigger than that. It's the only way it could happen if it was bigger than that. The rabbit hole goes infinitely deeper than that level of it. And if you only stay at that level and you will not expand and look at the deeper levels of the rabbit hole, then eventually, of course, as I say, you're going to basically work out the mine, you're going to work out the oil well of information, and you basically going to then spend the rest of your time, in effect, repeating what you've already said. And what happens then is things lose their momentum. Because, oh yeah, I've heard it before, and you're saying the same thing again. When we're dealing with all possibility, and we're dealing with the scale of what's going on, then we have to constantly keep expanding our awareness and our area of research with the understanding that it is much bigger than ever people thought about. And therefore, when you do that, the momentum continues, because you're constantly uncovering new things, new levels to it. And in the end, this is not going to, this is only going to really change when the, see, this reality that we're experiencing is very, very akin symbolically to a movie theater.
Yeah.
You know, by the time you're looking at the movie screen, it's a done deal. It's a done deal. You've got the actors acting on the screen, and you're watching them. There's no way at the point where that movie hits the screen that you're going to change it. No way. It's a done deal. And so the same with our reality. When we have decoded the vibrational information into electrical information, into holographic information, by the time it hits holographic information and we're experiencing it, it's a done deal. You ain't going to change it there. This is why the system is quite happy for people to believe that the answer is out there as we perceive it. It's not. As we experience the world, it's happened. It's a done deal. You're going to change it now. What we need to do is to go to deeper levels of self, what we call the subconscious, and not just the subconscious of the individual, but the subconscious of this reality, the information waveform level of this, in the movie theater terms. We need to get to the back of the theater where the projector is, and we need to change the reel. Because if we don't change the reel, that movie, done deal, is going to keep playing out on the screen. And so the rabbit hole is much deeper. It's much deeper in terms of how the cabal and the control system is orchestrated. And it's much, much deeper in terms of where it comes from and where the answer to it comes from. Because in the end, everything is a manifestation of waveform information, vibrational information. That's what we have to change. And if we just go round and round in the garden, as much of the conspiracy research movement has started to do, and won't go any further, that Ike's crazy, or he can't go there, that's mad, that would never happen, it's not in line with my religion, and anyway, it's not in line with my vision of reality, I ain't going there, then of course, it's bound to lose momentum. It can't help it.
Interesting. To take it to a personal level here now, I take it, based on what you said earlier, you know, that you're sort of just relishing this life. You don't really wish that things had gone differently or that you hadn't really gone on this journey. So we don't really need to go there, I guess you could say. But, you know, looking back, if you hadn't gotten into all this, if this awakening hadn't happened to you, what do you think would have become of David Icke? You know, you were pretty much a rising star there in the Green Party and a television presenter. You know, where do you think you'd be here in 2010?
I'd probably be kind of coming to the end of a television career or something like that. But because, you know, my journey was never going to be that, it was always going to be this. And so I don't really think about where I was going to go. I mean, you know, I look at my life, and I wouldn't want to be anyone else doing anything else but me doing this. And you know, that's a privilege, really, because I'm sure there are many, many, many unbelievable numbers of people in the world that wouldn't have the wouldn't say that about their own lives. So I wouldn't change that. I mean, I'd change some people that came into my life. I mean, one of the ironies is that some of the people that have told me most times verbally how much they love me and how much they care for my work and how vital my work is and it must get out there have turned out to be the people that have been most challenging to my health, my life, my work. That's a kind of irony, but I've learned a lot from it. You know, it's an experience, and therefore it's an experience I've grown from. But I would rather it not have happened. Life would have been easier without it, I can tell you.
Yeah.
But you know, you accept these things and you get on with them. And I wouldn't change anything that I'm doing. And I just look forward. You know, I think, you know, it's 20 years since I consciously started to awaken. And when I look at the amazing things that I've seen and come across, and of course we're going down the rabbit hole. Therefore, they're going to become more amazing and more extraordinary. And as we get deeper in the rabbit hole, more and more potent to what is necessary to turn this around and make a difference. So, you know, I look forward to the rest of my life with tremendous anticipation. And I don't want to leave this reality, no matter what happens, until the job's done, really, or my part in it's done anyway.
Well, that's a perfect segue to the final question here before we get to what's next for you. And that's, sort of an existential question. That's, you know, you've been doing this for 20 years. I guess the existential part of it is, like, when do you know when you're done? When is the work done?
I think from my experience over this period, my work will be done when I'm no longer here. You know, I think that's it, really. I think that, and I kind of came across this right early on, 20 years ago, this theme in my life, that there are people who are here to push the pyramid over, if you like, push the control system over. And then there is the next generation who are there to build up a new world in a new energy with a new, from a new point of perspective and consciousness. And we're seeing those generations coming through now, the younger people of today and the children and younger people of today, are coming through, and there are some amazing young people in the world. I get fed up of seeing young people criticized and put down all the time. If I had spent my early years consuming, cocktails of, chemical poisons in what we call food and drink and all the rest of it, then I would probably go off the rails as well sometimes, because it's rewiring the brain chemically. That's what they're doing. It's absolutely outrageous. And when they've rewired the brain, then they say, oh, behavior problems, we've got to give you Ritalin and all the other stuff. So they're bombarding young people for the same reason that we talked about earlier. They're trying to knock them off kilter at this fantastic time of potential change of awareness and consciousness. But those generations, there are some fantastic young people, some amazingly aware young people, and they're the generations coming through to take it on to the next stage as the truth vibrations become the dominant information source in this reality. So I'm going to keep going until I keel over, because when I keel over, I know it's done. And I hope that when I get out of this body and I look back from an out-of-body state, and I'll symbolically smack my hands together and say, job done. That will be great. And there's so many people that now around the world who are playing a part in this, and there'll be more all the time. Every time someone else awakens, there's another man in the team, another woman in the team, another child in the team, another young person in the team, and it's just going to go on expanding. But we're at the cusp now where the, as I've said many times, the immovable object, which thinks it is, the control system, is coming face to face with the irresistible force, which is, and that's this information vibrational change that we're experiencing.
Well, before I sort of get into the what's next for you, let me run down the tour dates so you don't have to. You're going to be hitting London September 11th, Prague September 25th, New York City on October 17th, San Francisco October 23rd, Lisbon, Portugal October 30th, Barcelona on November 6th, Amsterdam November 27th, and then over in 2011, you'll be in Kiev, Ukraine, Mexico, and Los Angeles. So just an amazing slate of appearances for you. And, of course, the new book, Human Race, Get Off Your Knees. People can find out all that information at davidicke.com. But beyond all that, what's next for you? What else do you have going on? New book coming up, or interesting research maybe that you're pursuing, or anything like that?
Well, in about 10 days, I'm going to South Africa to spend 2 weeks with Credo Mutwa. I'm going with Bill Ryan from Project Camelot, who's going to do the filming, and we're going to go through as much information that's inside that amazing man as possible. So it is preserved for all time, because it's not got many people, if any, to pass his amazing knowledge onto. And so I'm going to go through it all with him over a period of 2 weeks, and videotapes galore, and get down out of him everything that he wants to share with us. And then also not only turn that into a library of DVDs, the Credo Mutwa library of knowledge, but also get it transcribed into some books for him as well, which will give him some income, because he's obviously struggling there often with all the things that he does and all the people he looks after. And after that, I'll be going around the world. But there's a big change happening in me, inside of me this time. And I'm getting more and more and more indications that there's a whole new level of awareness, a whole new level of perception and understanding that's about to be unveiled in the next few months or so. I can feel it. You know, I'm going through tremendous changes myself, and it's like there's just a whole amazing new world about to be put before me, I think. That's the feeling I'm getting and the indications that I'm getting. And it needs to, too, because, you know, we have to keep moving. We have to keep expanding our understanding. You know, I've used the analogy before of you come out of the womb, and most people pitch their tent very soon afterwards and say here and no further, and then other people go a bit further and they'll be environmentalists and they'll pitch their tent and say here and no further. Some people will then go a bit further and they'll pitch their tent and they'll say the 5 cents mainstream conspiracy research but no further, and then some people go extraterrestrials and pitch no further. But if you haven't got a tent to pitch, you just keep walking. Then the adventure goes on, and you know, amazing things are put before you that if you pitch your tent, you'd never see. And like I say, I don't have a tent. I'm not going to pitch it. I just want to enjoy the amazing adventure of seeing more and more of what is unfolded before me. And it's just an amazing thing to experience. And I'm just so privileged, I think, to be me doing what I do, because I wouldn't want to be anyone else doing anything else, and that is a privilege, like I say, in itself.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, David, we've come to the end of the conversation. Before I thank you personally, I want to thank your son, Jamie, for really helping me out to get this whole thing up and running. He's a great kid, and he did an awesome job, you know, making this happen. And I want to thank you, of course, for coming on the show, for being our season finale guest. I've wanted to talk to you now for like the last 5 years, so to have the opportunity has really been just amazing for me. This has been a tremendously enlightening conversation. It's, as I said, pretty rare really to get sort of the optimistic point of view when it comes to this whole conspiracy thing, and it's really refreshing that your research has gone down that road, and it really sort of ends the season here on a hopeful note, which is great, because you know, a lot of people in the paranormal community, parapolitical community, esoteric community, you know, they're sort of held down a little bit by fear of the future. But it sounds to me from this conversation that while we still have to be active and still have to keep waking people up to what's going on, that there is light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, so thank you for sort of imparting that knowledge to us. And once again, thank you so much for coming on BOA Audio, for being our season finale guest. And I hope this is not the last time we talk about all this amazing stuff.
It's been a real pleasure, Tim. And, of course, the end of everything, no matter what happens, no matter what we experience, at the end of the day, we are infinite consciousness. We are all that is, has been, and ever can be, having an experience. And no matter what happens, we're always that. You know, what is there to fear? Nothing.
That does it for the season finale of BOA Audio Season 5. Big, big, super huge thanks, of course, to the incomparable David Icke for coming on the show and for being our special season finale guest. You can find out more from David Icke at the website www.davidicke.com. Pretty simple, all one word, davidicke.com. Check it out. Moving right along now, as I've been saying over the last few weeks, since this is the final episode of Season 5, we're not going to do any listener feedback. Wanted to sort of devote the end of this program here, the final episode of the season, to providing some feedback to all you great folks out there. First of all, of course, I want to give a hat tip to all of the great guests we've featured on the show this past season, from Jim Mars and Governor Jesse Ventura on Episode 1, all the way to David Icke on Episode 33. In previous years, I would list all the guests here at the end of the show, but trust me, folks, we're talking about a 40-plus list of people who've been on the program this season, and nobody wants to listen to me read through that list here at the end of the show. So, overall, allow me just to give a hearty thanks to all the great folks who've appeared here on BOA Audio Season 5, all 40-plus guests, for helping us to create another fantastic and fascinating season of BOA Audio. Over the last couple of weeks, I've definitely been doing some reflecting on the season here. It's been tumultuous at times. There have been some heady gaps between episodes, but I think at the end of the day, episode for episode, I would say season 5 certainly stacks up against the previous seasons of BOA Audio. It's been quite the season. I was looking back at some of the episodes, you know, from the first 10 or so editions of BOA Audio season 5, and it's stunning to me how much time has gone by since those interviews were posted. Just amazing to me that they were all part of the same season. So collectively, it is quite the group of researchers and experts on just an amazing array of paranormal genres. So just stunning stuff to me. And of course, once again, big, big, super huge thanks to all the great folks who gave us their time and appeared here as part of BOA Audio Season 5. Of course, I want to hear from all you folks out there. This is the final episode of the season. You've heard 33 editions of the program over the last 9 months. I want to hear your thoughts on the entire season as a whole. Plus, as we've been saying here for the last few weeks, I want to know who you want to hear on Season 6. What topics do you want to hear covered on the next season of BOA Audio? How do you do all that? That's easy. There's 3 main methods to get a hold of me, plus the social networking sites. Let me roll through the list here for you. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. That's pretty easy. I check that every day. Or just go to banalofamerica.com, BINNALLofamerica.com, and click the contact button. And, of course, the final method is to join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. We call it BOA's Paranormal Playground. It is quite the group of folks there having a lot of fun talking about the paranormal as well as the world of pop culture and sports. So if you're interested in finding a place to hang out and chat during the off-season of BOA Audio, you definitely want to swing over to theusofe.com and join up and join in on the fun. As noted, I'm also available on all the various social networking sites, Twitter, Facebook, and MySpace. Befriend me, follow me, poke me, it's all good. So those are the main methods: email, contact button, BOA forum, and the social networking sites. Get a hold of me, folks. Up next, obviously, is the thanks portion of the program. Allow me to tip my hat and thank the outstanding BOA staff for all of their friendship, support, and insight throughout Season 5. It has absolutely been invaluable to this program. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolan, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. These folks have really done such amazing work for Banal of America over the last 9 months and beyond. Hugely supportive of the program, always offering their thoughts on not just the latest episodes, but what direction the show should go as things progress. They have the inside track on BOA Audio, and they are just an amazing sounding board for me to get some insight into what the listeners might be thinking. And in addition to that, their contributions have really helped BOA become more than just a podcast. It's really fueled the evolution of this franchise into one of the premier paranormal websites on the net. And I can't thank all of them enough for their part in making that happen. Thank you, thank you, thank you to the BOA staff. You guys are amazing. It's been a true joy to work with you, and I want to thank you in advance for your contributions here during the downtime, and I'm looking forward to seeing what y'all come up with here over the next few weeks and months as we get ready to roll out BOA Audio Season 6. We say it week in and week out, folks, but now more than ever it's true. If you're only listening to BOA Audio and you're not reading the columns at Banal of America, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Before we go any further, I would be remiss if I did not stop the program right here and now and offer out the biggest thanks of all, and that definitely goes out to all of you, the amazing BOA listeners. Thank you so much for your tireless support of this program, your donations to help keep the operation up and running, and your patience during the down times when we've been extremely late with posting episodes. That is something I'm certainly aware of, and I hugely appreciate the fact that you guys keep coming back for more BOA Audio. it never ceases to amaze me really how massive this program has become. And trust me, every time I consider that, it is not lost on me that the remarkable growth of this whole program is entirely thanks to you guys, the listeners. You've made this program a global phenomenon via your grassroots support, and it is really and truly humbling to stand at the helm of the mothership as we journey together through the realms of the unknown. I've said it at the end of every program this season, and I mean it, folks. You are the fuel that drives this machine. You are the source of power for BOA Audio. You guys are what makes this whole thing happen. Don't ever underestimate what you've done for this show. It is as much your fucking program as it is mine. And I want you to know how much I appreciate all of you out there for your support. It really is something that keeps me going week after week throughout the season, knowing that there are so many people out there that are looking forward to hearing the show, that it really helps get me out of bed some tough mornings and makes me go to bed early some rough nights when I know I got to tape a big interview the next day because I know folks are going to want me on my A game. So I'm just getting a little choked up here, but I want to thank you all for your support. You guys are awesome. I've already pestered you once at the beginning of the show and during the middle, but let's go for the trifecta here, folks. I really desperately need your financial help as we close the book on BOA Audio Season 5. I would definitely like to close the financial books and have us, at the very least, breaking even on the season. You've heard 33 episodes so far this season. We've interviewed 40-plus guests on the program. Just the phone bills alone for that sort of thing, as well as the bandwidth, takes a tremendous financial toll on yours truly. And much of it is offset over the course of the season by the great BOA Audio listeners who make donations. There's no sense in me beating a dead horse. All I'll say is that you can make a donation via PayPal by going to Banal of America, or you can just send us a donation via snail mail. No need for me to read the address once again. You got it at the beginning of the show, and you can find it at banalofamerica.com. So head on over to the website, either click the PayPal button or jot down the snail mail donation address. And if you could help us out, that would be great. Shoot us a donation, as we say all the time here, folks. If you can only shell out a little bit, that helps, trust me. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to help keep the entire franchise freely available for all you great folks out there heading into Season 6. And I don't want to make any grandiose promises here, but I will say that I would certainly like to have the season premiere of Season 6 done maybe 10 days to a week ahead of time and make it available to folks who make a donation. So there's a little bit of an incentive there for those folks who make donations to Banal of America. If you've already made a donation during Season 5, don't worry, we've got you on the list. And when Season 6 is ready to kick off, keep an eye out in your email inbox for information on where you can find the special donors edition of the season premiere of BOA Audio Season 6. So I don't want to just ask you for your donations just to help us out. I also want to be able to promise you something here as Season 6 kicks off. I know I make a lot of promises about getting episodes posted by deadline and stuff like that, but I can assure you I will deliver on this one for the great folks who have helped us out. Traditionally, this is where we tease the eventual return of BOA Audio in the form of, obviously, an all-new season of programs. As of this moment, we are looking at a late November, early December time frame for the premiere of Season 6. I'm thinking shortly after Thanksgiving, most likely, if not maybe the week before Thanksgiving. And while I got a little choked up here reflecting on all you guys and how awesome you are and how huge you've been to this show, I'm not particularly saddened, I guess you could say, about closing the book on another season of the program. In previous years, I would be really sad about it because the future of the show is always tenuous at best. But this year, I'm really signing off very comfortable in the knowledge that we already have a slew of guests lined up for Season 6. I mean, I sat down and made a list of all the folks that either have committed to coming on the show for the next season of the program, or that I know for sure will be back on the show next season. And it's quite a list already. And I can tell you right now, it's only a short matter of time before I start sitting down and doing the research and taping these interviews. I can't say too much more about Season 6, except for the fact that, as always, we'll be welcoming back some of our favorite previous guests, as well as some intriguing new voices on subjects ranging from the familiar to the paranormally peripheral, and altogether doing our best to bring you the most unique paranormal content in all of esoteric podcasting. So stay tuned to BOA over the next couple of months for news on Season 6 as it becomes available. And, of course, shoot me your guest suggestions, topic suggestions, and thoughts on not just Season 5, but what you'd like to see in Season 6. I'm happy to be taking a break. I'm looking forward to having some downtime. Of course, for the folks who listen to the Popcast Initiative, this is not the last time you'll be hearing from me over the next few weeks. We've still got four more editions of the Popcast coming at you through September and October, but I am definitely going to miss talking to all you great BOA Audio listeners here at the end of the program each week. It is truly a joy. It is really such an amazing gig that I really and truly love doing, and I hope we can continue this journey year after year after year, and that Season 5 is just one more small step in the amazing legacy of this program. I don't have anything else to say, so I guess we'll shut it down here and now, folks. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, wishing you an excellent autumn, thanking you for your support over the course of BOA Audio Season 5, and signing off.